I'm Robin Young at Boston Fleet Center.
I'm Michael Goldfarb.
It's Here and Now.
A massive car bomb exploded in Iraq today. More than 65 people, apparently all Iraqis, were killed. The incident took place near a police station in Bakuba, around 35 miles northeast of Baghdad. The suicide bomber detonated himself as a bus went by. At least 21 of the dead were riding on the bus. Joining us on a line from Baghdad is Elaine Cobb. She's a correspondent for CBS Radio News. Thanks for joining us, Elaine.
You're welcome, Michael.
Now, what are the latest details on this incident?
Well, the suicide attacker chose mid-morning to strike when the town center was crowded. The main target, a police station, is beside a busy market, so scores of shoppers were caught in the blast. And the station is used as a recruiting center for the Iraqi police force, so there were dozens of men waiting in line to sign up. And as you said, a minibus going by was also hit, and most of those passengers killed instantly. Eyewitnesses say the man drove right up to the police station and exploded the car, and just a terrible scene of carnage. It's been this has been the deadliest attack in Iraq since the handover of power a month ago.
Now, Bakuba, remind us again, it's a place where there is a fair amount of insurgent activity.
Yes, it's a flashpoint town in Iraq. It's part Sunni, part Shiite, but it's been a stronghold of insurgency and activities against U.S. forces and now against the police and Iraqi military linked to the interim government that many believe is no better than the American occupiers before them.
The response in the street, yet again, this is another incident. I mean, the insurgents say that they're targeting the U.S. occupation or its collaborators, but time and again, the real victims are just ordinary Iraqis trying to do a bit of shopping, as you described.
Yes, these were all Iraqi civilian casualties. Clearly, the suicide bombers, who have been very active over the last few weeks, are timing their attacks for maximum carnage. There have been early morning attacks when people are going to work. This is mid-morning at a market. They really are clearly going for the maximum impact, possibly because they know they will get more coverage that way from the international media. Also, they know it will make the police, who are often targets, possibly more unpopular, and they're trying to stop the flow of recruits to the Iraqi police. But it's not going to be easy to do that because there simply aren't many jobs here in Iraq. The reconstruction contracts went to largely American companies or other international companies who have been hiring outside of Iraq, and people here are very angry at that. So they need the jobs, and at every recruiting station, there are always lines of men waiting to sign up.
Elaine, we're coming to the end of the first month in this transition period. You have an interim government in place. The handover of sovereignty took place, yet this month, for example, more American soldiers have died in Iraq than they did in June, the last month of the occupation. Interim Prime Minister Iyad Alawi has been very clear about not standing for this kind of activity. Do you get the sense that he has begun to get to grips with the problem, or is it all words when we hear Prime Minister Alawi saying that he will not tolerate this kind of insurgent activity?
I don't think it's just words, but this is a country that has been lawless for the 15 months since the invasion. The attacks on American forces have been holding steadily. Yes, there are more Americans dead, but that's largely because there's been an increase in accidental deaths. But attacks on the Iraqi forces, who've been taking over more and more of the security issues, have increased very heavily, and they're paying a very high toll for this, for the handover.
Elaine Cobb, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Elaine Cobb is a correspondent for CBS Radio News. She joined us on a phone line from Baghdad.
Senator John Kerry has arrived in Boston. Television pictures show him waving to tourists on boats in Boston Harbor and posing for pictures with fellow veterans. Tonight, he accepts his party's nomination and hopes to make an impression on the electorate. WBUR's Audie Cornish is in Boston Harbor. Well, actually, I should say, Audie, you're at the harbor. To be in it would be uncomfortable. I know you're waiting for Kerry to speak. What's on the schedule for today for him?
Well, Kerry is arriving from a six-day campaign stint that began in Colorado and is ending in his hometown of Boston. He's going to pull up into the area of the harbor called the Charlestown Navy Yard. So there are a couple hundred supporters here waiting with signs that say Stronger America, and it's really kicking off the campaign's convention theme tonight about security. He's supposed to lay low today and be in private meetings until tonight when he'll be at the Boston Symphony for a pop concert.
And as he is on our boat right now. We can see that he's heading towards the beautiful skyline of Boston. Has he said anything about what he plans to say tonight?
We haven't heard anything about that. We know that the convention is broken up into several themes, and tonight will be a Stronger America. It's sort of the opening salvo from the Democratic Party to say that a Kerry Edwards administration will be able to take over in a time of heightened security concerns, heightened national and international security concerns. There's supposed to be at least 13 retired generals and admirals who are going to be endorsing him today, and there'll be sort of a highlight reel of them talking about Kerry's abilities and why he'd be a good match for the electorate on issues of security. So that's all we know for now.
Mm-hmm. Audie, what are people around you saying, if anything, about Senator Kerry's wife's speech last night to the convention? Teresa Hines Kerry addressed the delegates.
There's been a lot of good buzz about that. A lot of women, especially, were very excited about her speech, and they had a very good feeling about it. Thought she was forceful. Thought she sounded passionate. And you know, after Hillary Clinton was on the night before, one of the most popular Democrats around, I think people were happy to see Teresa Hines Kerry really step up and take her place as a potential first lady.
Not only that, but the way she spoke. I mean, some people are saying she has said she's shy and soft-spoken, but it seemed very appealing to the ear to most people to hear someone speak in kind of a normal tone.
Yes. Her entire approach was very well received by the delegates that I've talked to.
So, Audie, I know you're, as I said, you're waiting for Senator Kerry to arrive. Who is waiting with you? Who's there?
There's easily 500 to 600 campaign volunteers. There are some delegates here. There are some neighborhood people here. We ran into a small crowd of people because they knew Kerry when he lived in Beacon Hill, or they are from his Beacon Hill neighborhood and are hoping to catch a hello as he passes from the harbor to his hotel. And then there, of course, the traveling press and a couple dozen press corps. So it's pretty packed up here on Pier 4.
Any protesters?
None that we can see. And there hasn't been much of a presence at the events that I've been to in general for the convention.
All right. Well, as I said, Senator Kerry is on a boat right now, steaming his way towards the Boston Harbor area where Audie Cornish.
Taxi.
I'm sorry?
From Logan Airport, and that's going to have 13 of his crew members from his tour at Vietnam. And he'll actually be making a statement from the boat in just a few minutes.
Oh, so that's a water taxi from Logan, from the airport?
Yes, it is a water taxi. And so those crew members are meeting him at Logan, and they're all going to pile in. And I think that's maybe what we're waiting for now. And then they're going to make their way over. And in the distance on TV, you may be able to see a charter boat that's there. It's a Nantucket Light ship, which is a refurbished ship that used to be off the coast of Cape Cod. It's got a huge Kerry Edwards sign. So there's a lot of things in the backdrop here between the Fleet Center and the bridge and the ship.
Very picturesque, and it looks like it's about to pour. Audie, thank you very much.
Thank you, Robin.
WBUR reporter Audie Cornish speaking to us from Boston Harbor.
When the Democrats announced they would be holding their national convention in Boston, local businessmen saw dollar signs, and daily commuters saw traffic gridlock in their future. Midway through the convention, the gridlock hasn't really materialized. And as for the businessmen, well, WBUR's Athena Desai went to see how several businesses in and around Boston are faring. She begins her story in Medford, Massachusetts, not far from Boston's Fleet Center.
Florid clocks strike noon in Ward's gift store in the center of Medford. The tunes are sweet, but the workers are sour. They say they've only seen 3 customers today.
And then with the DNC now, everything blocking off, it's you can't do anything. You know, it's like a ghost town.
Assistant manager Todd Casey says the city of Medford banned street parking outside his store after 2 p.m. to allow for overflow traffic from the convention and I-93. Medford's about 7 miles outside downtown Boston, but with no overflow of people from the convention, Casey says the store is suffering.
You get specific items in the summer, and with this being a huge tourist season time, that's when we get, you know, a lot of our good sales from that. And when stuff like this happens, we're stuck with this and we can't do anything about it.
The light in Medford Mayor Michael McGlynn's office is tinted by patches of red, white, and blue. There's a 45 by 90 foot flag that covers his windows in City Hall.
And it's up there as a symbol to remind people, even though you have some aggravation during conventions, that's the symbol that represents our freedoms, what people fought for, and what political conventions and the political process, the democratic process, represents.
The mayor says many of those who built or work at the convention site live in Medford.
We're a blue-collar district. The security, $50 million in security. It didn't go down the drain. It went into the pockets of people who work their shifts and now can put that back into the economy, help their family.
Closer to the convention site is Boston's historic North End. Cafe Vittoria is a favorite tourist trough, and it's a 5-minute walk from the Fleet Center. But manager Kenneth McCracken has a ready answer if you ask him how business is going.
It's terrible. Couldn't be any worse.
The cafe seats 300. Right now, it holds 9. McCracken faults the closed highway exits and strict delegate schedules. He says this week he isn't coming close to doing the amount of business he'd normally do.
I would order like 8 to 10 cases of coffee, 30, 60 trays of tiramisu. I didn't order anything. It's not right.
Across the street, a handful of idle restaurant owners discuss the percentage their business is off since the DNC began.
80%.
100%.
I'll go 50, 55.
Pino Irano says he's a Democrat through and through.
I was the only one optimistic about this convention. But then I find out that we've been hijacked by the Democrat Party, by the leaders of the Democrat Party, and worse more, by our mayor, which is an Italian too. Mayor, you lost my vote.
And I agree.
Paolo D'Amore lives on the North Shore. This week he's sleeping on someone's couch.
When you're in a small business, okay, it only takes 1, 2, or 3 weeks to get to failure. Failure means you have no business, you don't pay your bills.
D'Amore adds the little guys are those who make the city and the country work. He says in November he won't be voting for the party that's shown little regard for people like him this week.
WBUR's Athena Desai.
Just ahead, we speak with Victor Novosky, publisher of The Nation, about dissent and Boston's quiet streets.
And later in the show, we speak to Congressman John Conyers about Barack Obama's scintillating speech last night.
I'm Robin Young at the Fleet Center in Boston.
I'm Michael Goldfarb.
It's Here and Now.
On time, on message, no surprises seems to be the motto of this extraordinarily well-stage-managed Democratic convention. Perhaps the only surprise this week has been how little protest there's been in the convention hall and around Boston. The city had planned for it. There's a massive police presence and a free speech zone. A wired-in pen was set up outside the convention site, the Fleet Center, to contain protesters. To find out why the city's been so quiet, I met up with Victor Novosky, publisher of The Nation magazine. We started our conversation at the historic Arlington Street Church, where Civil War abolitionists railed against slavery and where draft cards were burned during the Vietnam War.
I distinguish between protest and dissent. And if you use the word dissent rather than protest, and you look at this convention, then you see that there are a lot of protests on the street. And there's a lot of dissent, not at the convention, but in all of the venues around the convention, including at a number of churches around town. That is both the outside protest and the internal dissent, they are on the same side. against the establishment and the over-organization of a convention, which, for the most part, most of the dissenters are in agreement with the short-term mission of the convention, which is to advance the chances of beating the Bush administration.
We left the Arlington Street Church and drove around Boston Common on our way to the Fleet Center and saw a remarkable sight, a man towing a large effigy of President Bush with his pants on fire.
It's from True Majority. It's Ben Cohen from Ben and Jerry's Ice Cream who runs True Majority. I volunteered to operate it. I saw it on the Internet. You can go to pantsonfire.net. You can learn all about it.
I thought that if you were looking for signs of public protest, this was a promising start. But arriving at the free speech zone, we found out it wasn't.
Well, here we are.
It's wildly empty now.
Yes. I find that quite remarkable, actually. Do you think that it's empty because people object to being, you know, put behind this double layer of metal screens? Or do you think it's empty because people have given up on this particular public occasion to express dissent or protest?
You know, it's very complicated because I think if people were really angry the way they were in 1968 and at other times in our history, screens inflame rather than discourage screens like this. I mean, this is so, in a funny way, it shows an over-anticipatory reaction. And it may be, as you suggest, that people don't have enough energy to want to put up with this for the amount of protests that they have within them. But the other factor, it seems to me, is when I remember I was standing with a couple of people the other night and someone said, what are they protesting against when they heard about the protest? He said, well, I suspect what they're protesting against is the war in Iraq and what's happening in Palestine in the Middle East. And that's not aimed at the Democratic convention's delegates or nominees in particular. It's aimed at, you know, the whole thrust of American policy. And so in a funny way, it's not the wrong that it's the wrong target. It's just not a target of maximum opportunity. So that must be part of it.
Do you think that there's an understanding even among those who, you know, make the effort to go to G8 summits, for example, to meetings of the World Trade Organization, that on this particular occasion, the political equation is really very simple, that it isn't about the Democratic Party's policies or trying to shape them, but it's simply about, you know, getting rid of Bush, and that they perhaps understand that if you give the non-liberal media, the predominant media in this country, an opportunity, they can make hay out of a small riot.
I don't think there's tactical reluctance. I don't think it's playing, it's not being here as a strategy. I think it's not being here as an energy. And the question is this the venue at which you can express that in the maximum way rather than an international venue like the World Trade Organization? There also may be a kind of new form of dissent that is evolving, and that has to do with all the venues around this convention where, although there's not a lot of noise in the streets about them, they're all packed. I mean, they're all filled. I was at one yesterday that authors who were protesting against the thrust of this administration. The place was packed. There were over 1,000 people in there. It was a church in Cambridge. But it was a civil dissent rather than sign-waving and inviting police retaliation, outdoors anti-civil dissent.
Victor Novosky may be correct. The left was largely missing from the protest zone. But the right was present. Around 8 people were on stage railing against the Democrats as the party of homosexuals.
As always, we welcome your thoughts on the program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org.
Or you can call our listener line and leave us a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, the senior senator from West Virginia, Robert Byrd, on the Kerry candidacy and the war in Iraq.
And The Daily Show pokes fun at everyone, regardless of political party, and we'll hear from one of the show's correspondents. That's tomorrow.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
I'm Michael Goldfarb.
I'm Robin Young at the Democratic National Convention.
It's Here and Now.
Well, for many, the highlight of the week at the DNC was last night's keynote speech by Barack Obama, Democratic candidate for Senate from Illinois. If Obama wins in November, he'll be the only sitting African-American senator, the fifth in history. Well, the founding father and now dean of the Congressional Black Caucus is Ohio's John Conyers. He's serving his 20th term in the House, and he joins us here at the Fleet Center. Congressman Conyers, what did you think of last night's speech by Barack Obama?
Well, I've seen the beginning of the first African-American that could become a prospective presidential candidate in the future.
Boy, what they're saying around here, you put in the word prospective, around the halls here, they're saying we saw the first African-American president.
Yep. Yeah. He's on a trail. His meteoric rise into the public, his completely grand slam first national convention's address, the fact that he is clearly intelligent, focused, committed, fair, and has this appeal, this Clinton-like charisma that is now a requirement to carry people forward in the national political arena.
I'm wondering if one line in particular resonated with you. Let's listen.
If there is a child on the south side of Chicago who can't read, that matters to me even if it's not my child. If there's a senior citizen somewhere who can't pay for their prescription drugs and having to choose between medicine and the rent, that makes my life poorer even if it's not my grandparent. If there's an Arab American family being rounded up without benefit of an attorney or due process, that threatens my civil liberties.
Congressman Conyers, I was thinking that you represent so many Arab Americans in your district, Detroit, so I was wondering if that line resonated with you because of that.
Well, I wasn't. I was carried up in the power and the passion and eloquence of his speech. You could have taken the teleprompter away from Obama. He would have made a passionate address. He might not have used the exact words that were crafted for last night. But you get the feeling that this is where he's coming from. He's not being programmed to come over as a compassionate person at the Democratic Convention. And that's what separates us. We're worried about getting as much passion into Kerry to try to tear some of those rather poorly scripted speeches away from him and let Kerry be Kerry. here are people that served under war conditions with him talking about his humanity more than you can see and carry the elite, blessed, upper-class dude. But there's the other Carrie that somehow his handlers aren't letting come to the fore. Obama gives you the impression that what he's talking about, he believes in.
Well, you mentioned your concern. You said you're worried about Kerry, and it's got to happen on Thursday night. I'm sure you saw the Washington Post poll that came out yesterday that a growing proportion of voters say Bush and not Kerry is the candidate who most closely shares their values. They still don't seem to know John Kerry, and what they do know, as you said, they're not feeling the humanity in him. What has to happen on Thursday?
Kerry has got to come through as a persuasively human being that will bring us all together, and it won't be through a brilliantly crafted speech.
It's something organic.
As far as I'm concerned, he could tear the speech up, and it's like a minister giving his first sermon before a congregation for them to see if they want it. Reading the most brilliant sermon in the world will get you kicked out of a Baptist church if you're trying out to be the pastor. And this is his trial sermon.
Congressman, I'm going to ask you if you could do a lightning round with us. Do you still think that Karl Rove should resign over the leak of the name of the CIA agent, the wife of Ambassador Joseph Wilson?
I think the U.S. attorney should check to see if that is a criminally prosecutable act.
Whether or not he did it because it was under his White House?
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay, number two. Do you still think that the U.S. should reinstitute the draft?
Well, the U.S. is the best kept secret in American government is that we finally run out of volunteers, reservists, and National Guardsmen, and under a Bush regime, we will have to reinstitute the draft. That soldiers don't come out of the sky.
Number three.
That's why they can't tell you that they're going to have to reinstitute the draft. Because if you believe in preemptive strikes, you can't do it without many more military than we actually have
to do the preemption. And number three, you have now famously appeared in Fahrenheit 9/11 telling Michael Moore, there's a scene with you and Michael Moore where he asks you something, I think it's about the Patriot Act, and you said it's a 500-page act, and you said, do you think we actually read those? Were you being tongue-in-cheek, or how did you feel about seeing that in the movie?
I haven't seen the movie.
Well, you're in it.
believe me, I know that. Yeah. But actually, I was the Patriot Act. The reason we didn't read the Patriot Act, it was substituted by the Attorney General. The night before it went to the Rules Committee, there were two copies on the floor, so there was no way to read the Patriot Act.
So that's what you meant, not that, politicians don't read what we vote on?
No, I do mean that, too. But the Patriot Act, well, if I could show you what we would be required reading, we'd never be able to do anything but read.
Your assistant just put his hand about 8 feet in the air to demonstrate the reading that you'd be doing.
The reading, on the for real side, if we vote on accepting the reporting on the floor, which is a very regular vote, you would have had to have read all the proceedings in the House of Representatives from the preceding day. That alone would have to stay up all night to do that. Yeah. In other words, this isn't as condemnatory as it may sound. What do you think we have dozens of staff people for? I mean, there's no other way that you can operate.
Congressman Conyers, we so enjoyed your visit, but you're getting taken away. So thank you for spending some time with us.
Thank you so much.
Congressman John Conyers of Michigan speaking to us here at the Fleet Center.
still to come. Reporters from all over the world are covering the Democrats. We'll hear from some of them.
You're listening to Here and Now.
It looked like overflow from Jay Gatsby's garden party. Pearls, top hats, gloves up to the elbow. A group called Billionaires for Bush, gathering by Boston's waterfront last night, swilling something that looked like champagne, but wasn't. The group turned out to be something else also. Neither billionaires nor supporters of the president. Here and Now producer Lindsay Crudell paid them a visit.
Far-flung colleagues of inordinate wealth! Today is a great day. Some of us have come by yacht, some by limo, and some by Learjet. Yet, in spite of these differences, we have all come together today.
Mega Bucks. I'm the richly upholstered co-chair of the New York City chapter of Billionaires for Bush. And describe to me what you see here. How is everyone dressed?
We're all in our finest, in evening gowns, tiaras, pearls, tuxedos on the gentleman, of course.
But without your tiara, your name is?
Alyssa, Gigi.
John Kerry is a pretty wealthy man. Could you make that same argument against John Kerry?
Well, I would say John Kerry may be a billionaire, but he certainly doesn't legislate like one. He's clearly beholden to the special interests of ordinary Americans.
My name is John McMillions, and I represent the entrenched WASP elite of the greater New England area. I'm a billionaire.
So let's say, out of character, how was this group conceived?
I mean, the idea is to use humor and, of course, to be funny, but at the same time, that's what reveals the truth. And then, depending on the protest, we can amp up our level of performance, you know, so sometimes if we want to infiltrate, say, a right-wing event, we'll be more or less serious until the right moment and then increase our rhetoric or whatnot and gradually sort of reveal that we're more or less a left-wing group.
What's your name and what are you doing here?
Buddy O. Bush, and I'm here to make sure that we have at least four more wars for the economy and that we make sure no billionaire is left behind.
And your real name?
Brian Fairbanks. Billionaires for Bush has the advantage of the humorous side of things, but the disadvantage that sometimes in passing you might not notice that it is a joke. Today we got a lot of dirty looks from college students because there were three of us walking down the street just in regular billionaire attire with stickers saying Billionaires for Bush on it. And I think people took us seriously and thought we were billionaires and that we were for Bush.
What did you just see pass by here?
Demonstration, Billionaires for Bush.
What do you think their message is?
Pretty much the message that Bush has been giving out. Well, leave no billionaire behind.
What do you see here?
Billionaires for Bush.
What do you think their message is?
Bush is great.
You think they're serious?
Extremely.
They just have this look in their eyes that they're really rich and that they don't care about the people. They don't care about the other 98%.
Because you know they're not.
They're not.
Who did you just see walk by?
Just dressed up like billionaires. And I think they are for Bush. I don't know. I'm not sure.
I think they are pro-Bush only.
Let them bow. Let them scrape. Let them peel us all a grape. The election is paid for by us.
Our visit to the Million Billionaire March last night was produced by Lindsay Crudell.
The election is paid for by us.
And an old-fashioned.
Stay with us. There's more ahead.
I'm Robin Young at the Fleet Center.
I'm Michael Goldfarb.
It's Here and Now.
Among the 15,000 reporters, cameramen, and photographers covering the convention are thousands of foreign correspondents covering the event for audiences around the world. Producer Karen Miller Medzin visited the Fleet Center, where she asked some members of the foreign media just how interested are the audiences back home.
Tim Over, the National Public Radio in the Netherlands. Oh, they're very interested, especially after the last elections. First of all, the outcome then in Florida an extra 5 weeks made them really frown their eyebrows, like, what's going on there? And now, with this whole polarization, not only in the U.S., but also in the world, they're really, really off following it, like, you know, as if they're going to vote tomorrow.
Bertin Leblanc, CBC Radio-Canada. Well, I think it's a, you know, it's a pretty big story for us because we are a neighbor, and everything who affect U.S. affect us pretty much directly, or a month later or a year later. But so it, actually there's a poll this morning in the newspaper in Montreal and in Toronto talking about the fact 85% of Canadians would much prefer to have John Kerry than George Bush.
My name is Gerhard Helskog. I'm from Norway. TV2 is a national public broadcaster in Norway. People in Norway, as in many places in Europe, are I have to say they really don't like Bush. They are afraid of him. They think he's a bully. And they find Kerry as a more reasonable man that they can understand and trust.
How interested are they in the actual process, the convention, the primaries?
I think the last election you had in 2000, what happened in Miami, has many people in Norway wonder what happened. If we can help you in any way, I'm just kidding. Many Norwegians, I have to say that, many Norwegians, as many Europeans, really admires the United States. But we are not very impressed of the way you're doing politics. We are not very impressed the way you handle the election. What you're seeing now is more like a show than it is actually democracy in working.
Salvador Sala, TV3, the national public television from Catalonia, Spain. Well, of course, in Europe in general, in my country, I'm so interested in those elections, because who will be the next president of the United States will be crucial for the future of the world, you know. We are in this huge war against the terrorism, and in my country the feeling is the way that George Bush tried to fight this battle is in the wrong side of the coin, if you want. And we need something to try to rally again the international community against the terrorism. That's the main goal in Europe. And for that, we need a president who also knew how to deal with the terror, not as George Bush is doing right now.
And how much do people in Spain know about John Kerry?
In my country, John Kerry maybe is the white hope for changing the White House. The people doesn't know so much about John Kerry, but they have a few ideas. Maybe the link between John Kerry, JFK, and with another JFK, John Fitzgerald Kennedy, maybe that works right now in Europe.
We are from Czech television, from Prague. But it's very strange for us. It's absolutely different political system and very different political ethics here. It's strange for us. It's like entertainment.
Producer Karen Miller-Medzen speaking to members of the foreign press at the Democratic National Convention. Now, people in Europe really have sophisticated knowledge of our elections. 100 left-wing Italian legislators recently sent a letter to Ralph Nader urging him to stand aside, saying his candidacy could cost John Kerry the election. Now, Boston Globe London Bureau Chief Charlie Sennett is in Boston this week to attend a conference and to cover the convention, and he joins me in the studio. Now, Charlie, leaving aside the Italian legislators, how do you find Europeans viewing this election? Are Europeans just skeptical about the process, or is it something more connected and emotional?
I think it's very connected, very emotional, and I think Europeans feel like this is the most important election in at least a generation, maybe two or three. I think the Europeans right now feel that if Bush is reelected, they are looking at four more years of defining themselves against America and essentially building their new Europe with the new expanded European Union, with a constitution in the offing. And what they're going to do is define themselves against America, look at America as the other. And if Kerry is elected, I think they feel that they could have 4 years, very pivotal years for Europe, in which they could actually define themselves much more as they have traditionally, in unison with America and in concert with America. So I think Europeans right now feel like this is their election as well.
Yeah, well, certainly in Britain, where getting involved into closer ties in the European Union, joining the single currency, how this constitution, which is in the process of being written, goes on. Pro-Europeans have for a long time been saying, oh, well, you know, we can no longer be, you know, in America's pocket. Our future lies with Europe, and certainly Prime Minister Blair and previous prime ministers all said, no, 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 we can have it both ways. But you get the sense that a Bush re-election might actually even force the hands of someone like Tony Blair in steering Britain towards a stronger and closer link with the European Union as its primary
I think
foreign
that's right.
affiliation.
Certainly, if Bush carries himself in, if he's reelected, in the next 4 years the way he has in the last 4 years. But what I've heard being here in Cambridge and listening to a lot of foreign policy people talking about the future, I think there's a consensus that Bush is going to have to change as well. So I think the way Bush approaches the world in the next 4 years will be tempered by the fact that he is aware now of the cost of alienating the world to the degree that he has in the last 4 years.
Early in the campaign, when John Kerry made his comment about he hears from foreign leaders all the time, and he got spanked for that a bit in the right-wing press and in the mainstream press as well because he didn't name names. Do you get the impression, though, that people, for example, that national leaders would suddenly provide troops and money, a real internationalization of the situation in Iraq, if there was a different president?
Yes. I think the multilateralism that is required is going to require the leverage of Democrats who have more authority and more respect in the world. And I don't think that's going to happen, or it's going to happen more slowly with Bush, because there is a sense in the world of a kind of constituency. It has no vote, but it can have a voice, and it can slow Bush down, and it can deny him the political gains that would come with a fast multilateral approach in Iraq. Sadly, the people of Iraq will suffer through this political dance.
And let's be clear. I mean, there's a very interesting poll in The Economist that shows only 6% of Europeans hold a positive view of President Bush. Well, if it's only 6%, that includes a lot of conservatives who
exactly.
dislike this particular conservative American administration.
Exactly. At this conference in Cambridge right now, sponsored by the National Democratic Institute, there are European leaders from all different political parties, conservatives, liberals, socialists, people's parties. And what I've been doing is spending a lot of time talking to them. And that's exactly what I've heard. You know, I talked to a guy who's a member of the Conservative Party in Germany, for example. Now, this is a country in which 90% of the people completely disapprove of George Bush. And it gets into the degrees of hatred almost. I mean, this is a personal loathing. And so he's very aware that his constituency, which represents 45% of Germany, includes a lot of people who don't like the way Bush is carrying himself in the world. And probably the most revealing thing I've heard on this is that the foreign policies between Bush and Kerry are not fundamentally different. Definitely not in the Middle East. Where they are different is in Europe, because in Europe, you've got a situation where they will be defining themselves in the next 4 years as they vote on a constitution, as the enlarged European Union begins to take shape in terms of security policy and foreign policy. And as they define themselves, that growth period could be stunted, many feel, by a Bush re-election, because of the way in which they'll define themselves against America. If there is a Kerry election, that growth will go more uninhibited, more unimpeded, and it will kind of more naturally occur. And I think that's a very important point for European unions. At the same time, everyone I've talked to is aware that the differences between Kerry and Bush on foreign policy are matters of style, not substance. But as one British diplomat put it, in diplomacy, style is substance.
Charlie Sennett, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Boston Globe London Bureau Chief, Charlie Sennett.
Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Michael Goldfarb.
I'm Robin Young.
Get into your radio.
And join us again here and now. We leave you with the sounds of John Mellencamp. His wife is a delegate here at the convention. He's rehearsing for tonight's show. We'll listen in and hope to see you tomorrow.
Hey, Steve. Is there any breakdown after the bridge part?
Yeah, that's it. That's a break, you know, but you can go back over.
What's happening, Andy?
Yeah, but you can do it, you know, just in a more dynamic, you know, you can do it in a more.
Just stay in, but stay.
Huh?
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.